My name is John Sweetman, and this is Lines of Inquiry Case Notes. Case Notes is a new strand of Lines of Inquiry, where we step away from telling one specific case in detail and instead take some time to reflect, to revisit past investigations, and to respond directly to you, the listener. We'll be speaking with expert guest contributors, diving a little deeper into the issues behind the stories, and responding to some of the much-valued correspondence that comes into our mailbox. If you have a message you'd like to share, a case you'd like us to revisit, or someone you'd like to hear from on future episodes of Case Notes, you can get in touch with us at linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at Lines of Inquiry Podcast to keep up to date. In today's episode of Case Notes, I'm joined by one of the leading voices in true crime in Ireland, Nuala Ní Chlaoighe. Nuala is the creator and host of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries, presented by Go Loud, where she explores some of Ireland's most difficult and often overlooked cases. She's deeply passionate about ethical storytelling with a strong focus on the victims, their families, and the broader context surrounding each case. Nuala, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me, John. I'm delighted to be on Lines of Inquiry, I have to say.
God, thank you.
And well
thank
done on all the success so far. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much. So, Nuala, what first drew you to covering Ireland's criminal cases on your podcast?
Well, I suppose I didn't know I was going to be drawn to podcasts. I used to be listening to, like, I had YouTube channels. I'd be watching, I was always into true crime, so I'd be watching on YouTube. I'd be listening to other podcasts. And then one day I was out walking my dog and I was listening to a particular podcast, a true crime one, an Irish one, and it was fantastic. And I was kind of going, I wonder, could I do something like that? And I saw a kind of a gap where cases weren't being covered, say, there wasn't a different case being covered in every episode. They were kind of serialized, which is fantastic. But I saw a little gap there and I got to work then kind of teaching myself how to use all the equipment and bought myself equipment and took about 6 months researching my first few episodes and writing out the scripts and then recording and afraid to press publish. It took me a while to actually press it. But then I got there in the end. And yeah, it kind of just took off. But I suppose what brought me there was a kind of a deep kind of wanting to help the families. You know, there's like a lot of the cases that are rarely in the news, especially like, you know, I know I've covered a lot of the more high profile ones, but there's also ones like, you know, yourself that aren't covered as much, you know, and I wanted to kind of give them a voice. So that's kind of the aspect I'm coming at it from, you know, if I can help anybody in any way.
Yeah.
Like I will certainly try to.
Like if an episode maybe jogs somebody's memory about something or whatever, like, you know.
That's what I always say. All it takes is one person to be listening, you know. Loyalties change over the years. A lot of these cases are 30 and 40 years old now. You know, somebody that was probably a bit nervous or whatever before to come forward, you know, might feel differently now.
Afraid to speak or, you know, maybe prevented to speak by somebody who's maybe passed away or something.
And us talking about the cases, you know, brings them back into the public eye and might give them the courage to come forward, you know, with that vital bit of information.
Like I know, like you had covered the Barbara Walsh case.
Yes.
And it was a story that we looked at in the first season.
Mm.
And it's a story I knew nothing about.
Same.
But yeah. I went down the rabbit hole.
You do fall down the rabbit hole.
You have to know kind of when to stop.
Yeah.
You know, and especially with that case, not having a resolution.
I know. That's what gets me, you know, for the families is not having this resolution, having to live with it every single day of your life. Because I've heard from so many of the families that they do literally live with it every single day in their lives. You know, if somebody dies naturally, be they young or whatever, you know, at least you know where they are. They're down in the graveyard. You can go visit them, as awful and all as that is. But to have a family member that's just vanished into thin air, you don't know what happened to them. You don't know what kind of a debt, more than likely, they had. It's just, I just find the whole thing so tragic.
Yeah.
So I do.
Yeah, but I hope that in covering those cases that maybe something will come of
that's
it. And even at the very least, it's making people aware that these things happen.
Absolutely.
And can be forgotten about.
And it might start a conversation, be it in, you don't know, in the pub over a pint or something, and a knock-on effect. It might get to the right ears. Even if it helped one case, out of all the cases I've done, I'd be saying, job done, I've helped one person.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're the same, John.
Oh, yeah. And I say that brings me on to, you know, the next thing, that we're both very conscious that these aren't just cases.
No.
They're people and their families. And, you know, how do you keep compassion and respect foremost in what you're doing? Like,
I'm always, every time I'm writing a script, every time I'm researching, I'm always doing it with the family firmly in the forefront of my thoughts. Like, you know, I'm always careful. Well, I hope I'm always careful about how I talk about the cases. You know, some of them, obviously, when you're doing research, they can be extremely graphic. I try and stay away from the graphics. It's not needed. Do you know what I mean? Mm. To tell the story, you know, because you have to be very conscious that family members are listening, you know, victim focused. That's, as you said at the beginning there, John, I obviously have to talk about the perpetrator. I mean, if you're talking about the whole case, but I don't make him the main focus of my attention. Yeah. You know, they're a side note in the whole thing. I try and keep it firmly on the victim.
Mm.
And like, you know, I don't want to turn their tragedies into something sensational, you know, and I just want to tell their story. That's basically it. Tell the story, keep it in the news, keep it in people's consciousness, and, you know, hopefully help. And even for the ones that are solved, you know, like, I suppose people might say, sure, why are you doing solved ones then? But like, you know, it's keeping people, I suppose, it's making them aware.
Yeah.
You know, people become more aware of their surroundings, more aware of who they trust, you know, you know, that these things can happen to anybody at any given time.
And it's like you say, like, you know, even with cases that have a resolution or an outcome in court or a sentence or whatever, you know, that means the end of the investigation. But like you were saying, it's not the end for the victims or their families.
No.
Like, they have a life sentence regardless of what the outcome is. So it's very important to keep that, I think,
you have to think
in mind.
Yeah, you definitely have to keep that in mind. I suppose you'd be looking at it from, obviously, they're living with it, as you said, every day. But then there comes the day in Irish legal, I suppose, the Irish legal world, where they're going to, life doesn't mean life for a lot of these guys. And the family are going to have to start dealing with parole hearings and bringing it all back to them again, you know, bringing it all, like, you know, I think the families, the victims' families, actually, you know, they have more of a life sentence than the actual perpetrator.
Oh, absolutely,
half the time,
yeah.
You know, because they're getting the short end of the stick all the time.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard. It's hard for the likes of us then, you know, we're focusing on hard evidence and our sources have to be, you know, checked and whatnot. And I think it can sometimes be hard to remain non-judgmental.
Absolutely. You know, especially, we're only human.
Yeah, like, especially me coming from, you know, being in the guards and being somewhat bitter and cynical about certain things, maybe the judiciary and stuff like that. But there's no place for that in what we're doing, but it can be hard.
It can be hard. Yeah. We're only human, as I said, you know, we've got thoughts and feelings. Obviously, you know, you keep some of them to yourself, even though sometimes you'd like to air them a bit more. But, you know, I suppose being a former Garda as well, like, you know, all the work that goes into solving a case for ye, and then half the time the sentences aren't what you'd have hoped.
Yeah. Or it can just,
that must be frustrating.
It can just turn on a dime, like, you know, like that could be years been put into a case and you might have what you might think is a slam dunk of a case and the outcome could be a lot different.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned fairly quick in my career to kind of not take that home with me.
Yeah.
If you go there, it's like what we're doing now. If you do your job or whatever you're doing to the best of your ability and you do it honestly, the rest, you can't carry it with you.
No, you can't. Mm. No. And I suppose that's the thing I learned from nursing as well. Like, you know,
oh, absolutely,
I
mean,
you know, you see a lot of sad stories, obviously, on a daily basis when you're nursing as well. Like, you know, but like that, you have to leave it at the door on the way home. Otherwise, you'd drive yourself mad, you know. Like, we all have mental health as well, so we have to look after it. Yeah.
Like
so we can do the job properly.
Yeah, like people used to ask me about, you know, maybe the gorier aspects of the job. And like, how can you do that? How can you do that? But it's not that you become desensitized. I think it's you realize the importance of the role that you have to play.
Yes.
And that takes the forefront. It's very interesting because, like you said, you spent years nursing, you know, dealing with people and being mindful of people's feelings and what they might be going through or what's happened. And you're still doing that.
Yeah,
you know,
just in a different way.
Just in a different way. The more I talk to you, I can see where you that the skills you got are built up in your nursing years have really stood you well now.
And it's an odd combination, I suppose, in a sense. But it works. It works for me anyway, you know.
It's not much different for me. Like, I'm retired now 2.5 years or so. And, you know, when I retired, I was like, that's it. That's done and dusted. I wrote a book to get it out of my system. And a little bit of exposure from that brought Go Loud knocking on the door.
Yeah.
And, you know, something I never, ever would have thought about.
Yeah.
And it's just...
It's a whole new world.
Yeah, it's a whole new world. And I just didn't know how I'd fit into it. But... It seems to work, like, you know.
You're fitting
like,
in fine, you know. John. You're fitting
and
in fine.
What I do find, and it probably took me a while coming from 30 years in the guards, I found now that I'm retired, that the shackles are off somewhat. I can speak my mind. I was never afraid to speak my mind. Like, if you ever see me with the tattoos and the whiskers and stuff like that, I was never your typical...
Garda Síochána.
Yeah.
Without, do you find you're able to think outside the box a bit more now?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Not as rigid as when you were in the Garda.
Yeah, because when I was in, you know, in the guards, and I was either dealing with fingerprint evidence or handwriting or document evidence or whatever it is. So it was a narrow vision, always with the end goal being you might be in court.
Yes.
That was it. You know, statement, you might be in court. So you have to do it this way.
So, yeah.
And like, I think we touched on it already. Like, a lot of the cases we cover don't have the resolution that you'd hope for. Like missing evidence, evidence going missing, victims who are never found, missing persons, court cases that, you know, the outcome isn't what people hoped for. And, you know, do you find those particular stories or cases more difficult to cover or more awkward or less satisfying, shall we say?
No, I don't find them less. I find them very frustrating when you're going through all the research and, you know, especially, you know, cases like the Vanishing Triangle, as it's been called in the press, like, you know, all these women that went missing back then. Not one of them has been found, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That I find very frustrating. How come not even one of them has been found, you know, to this day? That's what I find extremely frustrating.
Somebody has to know something.
Somebody, you know, of course.
About one of them, if not a few of them.
Like, do you know, and they're not ancient history, these cases. You know, they're from the 90s, I suppose, late 80s, 90s, kind of. I mean, that's not 100 years ago.
And I suppose it's just unfortunate for those girls that went missing that it was at a time kind of before we were, you know, Big Brother was watching us everywhere, social media, mobile phones.
Ring cameras.
All of these things.
Dash cams.
You know.
None of that stuff existed back then. Jojo Dullercher was last seen at a phone box, so that'll timestamp it for you.
Yeah.
You know, so that in itself, and even if there was CCTV, you remember that CCTV back in the day, and you'd be saying, why did they even bother spending all that money on those cameras? Because it's just pixels.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know?
Whereas today, you can't go anywhere. And
no.
You'd like to think that today, the likes of that, you know, all of those
cases,
women going missing couldn't happen or would be solved.
Yeah.
Or at least some of them could be solved.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the hope, isn't it? But like, you're the professional, you know, here in the sense that, like, without a body and without a crime scene in today's world, is that still, are you still coming at it from a back footing?
Yeah, like, I mean, there are cases where there's no body, but there might be a possible scene, you know, there might be traces here, might be traces there, but we have no body, no murder weapon, you know, no physical evidence and that sort of stuff. And even when you do have what you might think is good evidence, it's tying that to a person, be it the missing or the deceased person or a suspect. And you know, getting it through the courts. Like we did that episode there not too long ago with Nora Sheehan.
Mm.
It was decades before he was
brought to justice.
Brought to justice. But they were lucky in the sense that they just didn't proceed with the first trial.
Yes.
Because if they had and he was acquitted, then
that would have been
that was it. But I can imagine for the investigators and for Nora Sheehan's family, it must have been so maddening and frustrating that
absolutely
this guy was still
walking around,
you know, not a bother on him.
And a lot of the times with a lot of these cases, they're walking around and, you know, it's a country place or something, you know, so they're probably living in the same town as the victims' families. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how, I can't comprehend how that must be, you know, you're going down to do your shopping and there is the guy that murdered your sister or your wife or whoever, you know what I mean? It's kind of mind boggling to me, you know, so I can imagine how frustrating that would be.
Yeah. So is there like one case that you've covered that really had an impact on you or, you know, you find it hard to put to bed after you've done an episode that, you know, something that sticks with you?
There's a few, I suppose most of them have a impact to you, but ones that really stick out in my head would be, I suppose, Imelda Keenan would be one.
Mm.
She went missing in Waterford back in 1994. And I suppose the reason for that would be I interviewed her niece, Gina Carey. Mm. And that just intensifies it. When you talk to family members, it makes it more real, if you know what I mean. So that one would definitely be one that sticks out. You know, listening to the emotion, the loss, you know, it just makes it all more real and everything's still unresolved. They, you know, they've been begging for it to be upgraded to murder for years and it's still seen as a missing persons case, which is very frustrating for the family.
Yeah, and it
she's
can take
obviously
years
not
and years
just
for
missing.
It to be upgraded. Like.
Yeah, but we're going on over 30 years now, you know? So I can understand their frustration there, you know? So that would be one that would, you know, I'm waiting for the day I hear it has been upgraded for them so that, you know, they might hopefully eventually get some answers, you know? Other ones then that really stand out to me would be ones involving children or the elderly, both very vulnerable ends of the spectrum in our society, you know? So I covered Deirdre Crowley there, it could be a year ago now, who was only 4 years of age and was murdered in a murder-suicide by her father, you know.
Yeah.
That one really kind of got me, you know, that was an upsetting one to cover. And then at the other end of the scale, you have Tilly Campbell from County Down, who was a 77-year-old lady.
Right.
You know, and she was murdered by a drunkard, basically. I don't know if you use that word nowadays, do you?
Well, several other ones.
Yeah. Who gave her a vicious death, you know? Mm. And not only that, then while the poor woman was dying on the floor, he ransacked the house and then set fire to it.
Yeah.
That one I couldn't get out of my head because you'd be thinking of elderly if we're lucky enough to be elderly.
And how can somebody do that? Yeah. Like, you know, get into the mind state that they can just do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I found up myself with a couple of cases over the years now. And likewise, okay, you remember the gruesome ones and whatnot, or your first, you know, dead body, first murder scene, that type of stuff. But I think with me, like that again, I've been lucky in that I haven't had to deal with too many cases involving kids.
Yeah.
I've dealt with cases involved with handwriting, the handwriting end of it, that involve children and stuff like that. And those ones are difficult, you know, just to get your head around.
Yes.
And if anything, it was the handwriting cases that I was involved in that stick with me more, because the whole nature of doing that, examining handwriting, is you're constantly, looking at, a letter or a suicide note or whatever the case may be. And you're constantly absorbing it because you have to look at all the details and all the constructions and stuff like that. And when you look at somebody's handwriting, say a letter written by a victim or something like that, that's like a little bit of a time capsule.
Yes,
back to when that moment when they wrote it, maybe their distress.
What their mindset was like.
Yeah, what the mindset. Yeah. And you're stepping back into that. And, you know, this is the ink on the paper that person put down there that may not be around anymore.
Yes.
But those ones have stuck with me over the years more than
I can imagine they would.
You know, more than the ones you might think.
Yeah, because you're getting into their head. You're literally in their head.
And when you're doing that, at least I found when you're doing that kind of examination stuff with handwriting, you're very much zoned out. It's you and the writing that's in front of you.
Yeah.
You know.
Nothing else exists around you.
Nothing else exists.
Yeah.
And so it's those ones. But recently, and again, I only was involved in the periphery of it, the Justine Valdez one. Mm. That one just really got under my skin.
Oh my God, yeah.
That you one, know, I am.
That's a very sad case. She, you know, an only child.
Yeah, and the parents moving here to find work, yeah, and bringing her over a few years later. And just this random thing happening that, yeah, you would never dream of. You, no, know, you know, you could get hit by a car or yeah, you could get mugged on the street or something like that. Yeah. But this random thing.
Yes.
And it turned out to be such a horrible.
It had such an awful ending, yeah, you know, even if they were. And she'd been seen, witnessed in the car by, yeah, so many people, you
but
know.
But then people wouldn't be even expecting something.
No, you wouldn't.
Like that.
You're going along but your day. I'm just picturing, yeah, myself running into Tesco or Aldi or something, and you see, you know, you're kind of, you're not in that mindset, yeah, of there's a girl in a car over there that's just after being bundled into a car. You know, you're not, yeah, thinking down those lines. You might think, oh, she's had an argument with her boyfriend or something. You
something
know,
like that. Especially
you
not
even
in
come
a,
onto your,
you know,
radar.
A leafy suburb or, mm, you know, in South Dublin or North Wicklow or wherever it is. But mm, yeah, I think it's one that I'll always...
It'll stay with you.
Stay with me.
Yeah.
And Niels, have you ever come across in some of the cases that you've covered where one small little thing, you know, can change everything in a case? Anything like that?
Yeah. The one that really comes to mind for me for that one is Elaine O'Hara. I mean... She was missing for ages, you know, yeah, they thought suicide initially and all that. And then we had an unusually warm summer.
That's right, yeah.
The summer of 2013. And the Vartry Reservoir in Wicklow dropped, mm, dramatically. And there, in all their glory, was all the evidence that had been thrown into,
yeah,
the,
it was just, because I remember when it happened, and I remember people talking about it in work. And even some of our own, yeah, were kind of like, there's no way that guard went out there and looked over.
Yeah.
And said, but that's what happened, like, you, yeah, know, like it's good police work with,
absolutely,
good luck.
But it was a, know, real sliding doors moment. You had that. It was a kind of like that started the ball rolling. Mm. And then amazingly within, was it 3 days? I think, I can't remember. It was about 3 days later, her remains were found,
yeah,
by a dog walker. I mean, just randomly, her dog kind of went. I mean, poor Elaine's remains had been out there for over a year, I think.
Yeah.
So in the space of 3 days, you had found all the vital clues that you, mm, needed, evidence, and you had the remains.
Yeah.
And that to me was mind-blowing. Like, so, we never get hot weather, really, in this country.
No, not much now, you know.
You know, so they were probably, our Graeme Dwyer was probably banking on the fact that reservoir was going to stay, you know, at a certain, yeah, level throughout, yeah, the year.
Yeah.
He wasn't banking on us having a lovely warm, yeah, summer that year. So that, yeah, that's the one that really, really, mm, when I was doing it, I was like, oh my God, this is unreal.
Yeah, like sometimes you just need one little thing which will maybe start the ball rolling, yeah, and snowballs, and then another thing follows and another thing follows. Like recently we covered the murder of Aunt Rosalina,
mm,
and initially it was thought that she'd committed suicide,
yes,
by hanging.
That's right.
But like that, I think it was a phone call from Antra's boss where she worked in the local mushroom farm. This was, mm, in Killinalec up in,
yes,
Cavan. And he said to the guards that there's no way that she was depressed. She was happy. She had booked tickets to go back home to Latvia. She was, mm, looking forward to that, to go back and see her daughter. So, you know, the guards looked at it a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And they got a second autopsy by a state pathologist, who said, no, this isn't, you know, this,
yeah,
is something different.
Mm.
It's not consistent with, you know, ligature strangulation,
yeah,
due to hanging, which would leave a certain type of marks and stuff on the neck. They got a structural engineer down or up from Dublin, and he was able to show that flimsy shower rail
wouldn't have been able
to support her, yeah, weight. And they could prove that. And that, you know, that's great evidence, because when it comes to a court case or trial or whatever,
mm,
and you're talking to a jury.
Yes.
You know, it's evidence like that,
oh, yeah,
is, it's black and white.
Yeah.
Like, it's not done up in legal speak.
Yeah.
You know.
That's like the an upcoming one. It's not out yet, obviously. Siobhan McLaughlin. She was murdered by her husband,
yeah,
in Dublin, going back, oh, it's going back 20 years now.
I'm just trying to...
of the Dyson,
yes,
Hoover.
Yeah, I think that's the same. I think it's the same structural engineer.
Really?
Yeah, because in getting a bit of background on the Aunt Rosalina case, I found out that it was the same structural engineer. I can't think of his name now.
He had staged the whole scene. Like,
it's very similar to that.
Yeah,
the Siobhan
that's
Kearney
what I was saying when you start to talk and they're about. I was there. That's because it's fresh in my mind now, obviously, because I've just done it. And I was saying, yeah, because he and I think it was a professor, Mary Cassidy, was basically saying as well that the flex wouldn't have been strong enough to cause the damage.
Yeah.
To her neck, and it broke basically. Like it would have broke if you know it was snapped.
Yeah.
So they think they're being intelligent with the way they set these scenes up, but
yeah, you know, sometimes I think they try to set things up too perfect or whatever.
Yes.
But it's always amazing that one small little thing can make a big difference.
It's like one little thread and you pull it. Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Fascinating. It is fascinating, actually. Yeah.
And you've already said, Nose, that you've had, you know, family members of victims and that on your podcast.
That's right.
So, like, do you ever find that they do get back to you, or you've maybe kept in contact with them and stuff like
that? Yeah, I've kept in contact with any of the ones that I have been on. I have kept in contact not with them, you know, not on a regular basis, but and I'd text them, see how things are going, and things like that.
That's great,
You know, like the Imelda Keenan one that I was talking to you about earlier, you know, like she was, Gina had just started this petition that she wanted signed, you know, to try and so that they'd have enough signatures to send to the Minister for Justice, you know, to try and get the case upgraded to murder. And that petition is still up there if anybody does want to sign it, you know, they're desperately trying to get the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, just to try so they'll have enough to send to the Ministry of Justice. You know, so that in itself, if I can help even that little way, you know, that's something small that you can do in the midst of everything else that you're trying to do, you know. So, Dean Roach's, you know, family, you know, I dip in and out with them as well, see if there's any news, you know, if there's anything that needs to be updated, you know. So, yeah, I do my best to.
Yeah, that's great. It's great that people
follow them up as much as I can.
And it's great that people trust you, like, you know.
Yeah, well, I hope they do. Yeah, because that's, you know, because I'm only out to try and help them. You know what I mean? That's the end goal for me. Even sometimes just to talk about it, if nothing ever comes of it, just for them to be able to talk about it and know that it's been blasted out to the nation.
Yeah.
Can give them a bit of peace of mind, you know, in itself.
Like I'm not around in this game as long as you are, but I have seen through the emails and whatnot coming in that, you know, people are grateful for these stories being told, and we have had contact with some family members and stuff like that, and it's been largely very positive. But it's to be trusted to say,
with their story
and to do it accurately and respectfully, but factually, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, and I suppose just it's important as well for the public to know that they're being trusted with the story as well, you know, and to talk about it respectfully and that as well, you know.
And the two of us, Nules, are involved in true crime, like it or not.
Yeah.
I never thought I would be. Well, you know, I worked in an industry
or whatever
cool,
that was
true crime. But now, now I'm kind of, you know, involved in it as, you know, a banner thing.
You're
to
the host
true crime
of one of their
and it has exploded, and I've seen it myself. I watch true crime documentaries. I like them when they're done right, you know.
Absolutely.
But do you ever worry about how these stories are consumed or anything? I don't.
Yeah, you would. You do worry, like, you know, that I suppose with doing the podcast comes responsibility, doesn't it? That you're, like you said, not telling the story for the sake of it and sensationalising it and adding bits that, you know, don't really exist just to kind of make it sound way more exciting whatever. Do you know?
Like you see some of these things and, you know, true crime and he never knew this was going to happen and then it happened, blah, blah, blah.
You know, just to suck people in.
Yeah, kind of. And but it's important then not to be too clinical.
No. Obviously you want to show that you have compassion and genuine compassion. And I think, you know, for you as well as myself, you can hear it. You can hear it through the radio waves or whatever they call them these days. You know, you can hear it that you, when you're telling your story, you have genuine compassion for the person whose story you are telling. So that's very important, I think.
Absolutely.
That the people listening trust the host, You know, that's important, I think.
Yeah, like, I mean, because when I said to a friend of mine there before Christmas that I'd met you and we were talking, like, and she was like, oh, Newells, I love Newells, I love Newells. And it's not like, oh, I love Iron Crimes and Mysteries. It's like, no, I'm listening to Newells.
Yeah.
So they trust you. And
I'm still trying to get a hit my head.
You know,
that.
They trust you and that's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I hope they do, because that's...
Because they know, okay, that you're not being... too clinical and too dry or whatever like that, but you don't, you know, you have to not step over that line into sensationalism or, you know.
It's like what I said at the start, you have to tell the stories with it in the back of your head while you're telling the story, somebody related to this person might be listening.
Mm.
So, you know, that's what I'd be always saying to myself as I'm recording, you know, that I don't want to upset anyone, I suppose. You know, obviously, sometimes people are going to get upset when they hear the story back again, you know, and it's all raw and what have you, you know. But they, I suppose, from our point of view, we're coming from a place of caring. Mm. You know what I mean? We're wanting to help. We're wanting to get justice for them. You know, let them find out what's happened to their family member.
Yeah, and not, you know, not necessarily justice in the legal definition.
No.
Justice as justice. In, you know...
Listen, I've heard it time and time again, John, and I'm sure you have now at this stage, from family members, that especially ones, say, that have people missing for 30 and 40 years, they're not even interested in justice in the legal term anymore. They just want their family member back in whatever way that means having them back.
Yeah, closure,
so they
of
can,
some sort.
Closure, so that they can bury them with their other family members, or, you know, that they've somewhere, that they know where they are, basically, you know. And that's, I've heard that so many times. That's the main thing I actually hear now, you know. So, like, as I always say, if you have information and you're afraid to come forward with it, just go to, I don't know, get a burner phone or go to, if there are phone boxes around, and just ring in the tip, you know what I mean? And tell the police if you're afraid to come forward yourself, you know, just give the information and let these poor people, you know, have some modicum of peace in their minds.
Well, Newells, thank you very much for joining me today. Like, we could talk all day.
We could.
Yeah.
Sure, we might talk again. You
absolutely
never know.
Yeah. You'll have me down to the milking parlour now,
I will. You can milk a few cows
let's
for me
say,
while you're there.
Let's just say that it's, you know, it's your podcast studio. That's not kind of some other thing I'm alluding to.
But I'm selling cartons of cream while you're there as well. Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, anyway, thank you very much, Newells.
Oh, listen, it was a pleasure and it's an honour to be on Lines of Inquiry. And,
well, thank you.
Keep doing. You're doing a great job. Stellar job.
And you too. Yeah. We're just following in your footsteps.
I know. So. Thanks very much, John.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, sharing it to your story on social media, leaving a comment below, or simply telling a friend you enjoyed it. Your support helps us make more episodes. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. And follow us on Instagram at Lines of Inquiry Podcast. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan, and Aoife Plunkett is our producer. Remember, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.